Chapter 16. The inevitable white man, the black will never understand the white, nor the white the black, as long as black is black, and white is white. So said Captain Woodward. We sat in the parlor of Charlie Roberts' pub in Apia, drinking long Abu Ames compounded and shared with us by the aforesaid Charlie Roberts, who claimed the recipe direct from Stevens, famous for having invented the Abu Ames at a time when he was spurred on by Nile Thirst, the Stevens who was responsible for If Kitchener to Carton, and who passed out at the siege of Ladysmith. Captain Woodward, short and squat, elderly, burned by 40 years of tropic sun, and with the most beautiful liquid brown eyes I ever saw in a man, spoke from a vast experience. The crisscross of scars on his bald pate bespoke atomic intimacy with the black, and of equal intimacy was the advertisement, front and rear, on the right side of his neck, where an arrow had at one time entered, and been pulled clean through. As he explained, he had been in a hurry on that occasion, the arrow impeded his running, and he felt that he could not take the time to break off the head and pull out the shaft the way it had come in. At the present moment he was commander of the Savoy, the big steamer that recruited labor from the westward for the German plantations on Samoa. Half the trouble is the stupidity of the whites, said Roberts, pausing to take a swig from his glass, and to curse the salmon bar boy in affectionate terms. If the white man would lay himself out a bit, to understand the workings of the black man's mind, most of the messes would be avoided. I've seen a few who claimed they understood niggers, Captain Woodward retorted, and I always took notice that they were the first to be kai-kai'd eaten. Look at the missionaries in New Guinea, and the New Hebrides, the Martyr Isle of Aramanga, and all the rest. Look at the Austrian expedition that was cut to pieces in the Solomons, in the bush of Guadalcanal. And look at the traders themselves, with a score of years' experience, making their brag that no nigger would ever get them, and whose heads to this day are ornamenting the rafters of the canoe houses. There was old Johnny Simons, 26 years on the raw edges of Melanesia, swore he knew the niggers like a book, and that they'd never do for him, and he passed out at Morovo Lagoon, New Georgia, had his head sawed off by a black married woman, and an old nigger with only one leg, having left the other leg in the mouth of a shark, while diving for dynamited fish. There was Billy Watts, horrible reputation as a nigger killer, a man to scare the devil. I remember lying at Cape Little, New Ireland, you know, when the niggers stole half a case of trade tobacco, cost him about $3.50. In retaliation he turned out, shot six niggers, smashed up their war canoes and burned two villages. And it was at Cape Little 4 years afterward that he was jumped along with 50 Buku boys he had with him fishing Beachy D. Murr. In 5 minutes they were all dead, with the exception of three boys who got away in a canoe. Don't talk to me about understanding the nigger. The white man's mission is to farm the world, and it's a big enough job cut out for him. What time has he got left to understand niggers anyway? Just so, said Roberts. And somehow it doesn't seem necessary, after all, to understand the niggers. In direct proportion to the white man's stupidity is his success in farming the world and putting the fear of God into the nigger's heart, Captain Woodward blurted out. Perhaps you're right, Roberts. Perhaps it's his stupidity that makes him succeed, and surely one phase of his stupidity is his inability to understand the niggers. But there's one thing sure, the white is to run the niggers, whether he understands them or not. It's inevitable. It's fate. And of course the white man is inevitable, it's the nigger's fate, Roberts broke in. Tell the white man there's pearl shell in some lagoon infested by 10,000 howling cannibals, and he'll head there all by his lonely, with half a dozen Kanaka divers, and a tin alarm clock for chronometer, all packed like sardines on a commodious, 5-ton catch. whisper that there's a gold strike at the North Pole, and that same inevitable white-skinned creature will set out at once, armed with pick and shovel, a side of bacon, and the latest patent rocker, and what's more, he'll get there. Tip it off to him that there's diamonds on the red-hot ramparts of hell, and Mr. White Man will storm the ramparts and set old Satan himself to pick and shovel work. That's what comes of being stupid and inevitable. But I wonder what the black man must think of the inevitableness, I said. Captain Woodward broke into quiet laughter. His eyes had a reminiscent gleam. I'm just wondering what the niggers of Malu thought, and still must be thinking of the one inevitable white man we had on board when we visited them in the Duchess, he explained. Roberts mixed three more Abu Hames. That was 20 years ago. Saxterf was his name. He was certainly the most stupid man I ever saw, but he was as inevitable as death. There was only one thing that chap could do, and that was shoot. I remember the first time I ran into him right here in Apia, 20 years ago. That was before your time, Roberts. I was sleeping at Dutch Henry's Hotel, down where the market is now. Ever heard of him? He made a tidy stake smuggling arms into the rebels, sold out his hotel, and was killed in Sydney just 6 weeks afterward in a saloon row. But Saxterf. One night I just got to sleep, when a couple of cats began to sing in the courtyard. It was out of bed and up window, water jug in hand. But just then I heard the window of the next room go up. Two shots were fired, and the window was closed. I failed to impress you with the celerity of the transaction. 10 seconds at the outside. Up went the window, bang bang went the revolver, and down went the window. Whoever it was, he had never stopped to see the effect of his shots. He knew. Do you follow me? He knew. There was no more cat concert, and in the morning there lay the two offenders, stone dead. It was marvelous to me. It still is marvelous. First, it was starlight, and Saxterf shot without drawing a bead. Next, he shot so rapidly that the two reports were like a double report. And finally, he knew he had hit his marks without looking to see. 2 days afterward he came on board to see me. I was mate then, on the Duchess, a whacking big 150-ton schooner, a blackbirder. And let me tell you that blackbirders were blackbirders in those days. There weren't any government protection for us either. It was rough work, give and take, if we were finished, and nothing said, and we ran niggers from every South Sea island they didn't kick us off from. Well, Saxterf came on board. John Saxterf was the name he gave. He was a sandy little man, hair sandy, complexion sandy, and eyes sandy too. Nothing striking about him. His soul was as neutral as his color scheme. He said he was strapped and wanted to ship on board. Would go cabin boy, cook, supercargo, or common sailor. Didn't know anything about any of the billets, but said that he was willing to learn. I didn't want him, but his shooting had so impressed me that I took him as common sailor, wages £3 per month. He was willing to learn all right, I'll say that much. But he was constitutionally unable to learn anything. He could no more box the compass than I could mix drinks like Roberts here. And as for steering, he gave me my first gray hairs. I never dared risk him at the wheel when we were running in a big sea, while full and by and close and by were insoluble mysteries. Couldn't ever tell the difference between a sheet and a tackle, simply couldn't. The four-throat jig and the jib-jig were all one to him. Tell him to slack off the main sheet, and before you know it, he'd drop the peak. He fell overboard 3 times, and he couldn't swim. But he was always cheerful, never seasick, and he was the most willing man I ever knew. He was an uncommunicative soul. Never talked about himself. His history, so far as we were concerned, began the day he signed on the Duchess. Where he learned to shoot, the stars alone can tell. He was a Yankee, that much we knew from the twang in his speech. And that was all we ever did know. And now we begin to get to the point. We had bad luck in the New Hebrides. Only 14 boys for 5 weeks, and we ran up before the southeast for the Solomons. Malaita, then as now, was good recruiting ground, and we ran into Malu, on the northwestern corner. There's a shore reef and an outer reef, and a mighty nervous anchorage. But we made it all right, and fired off our dynamite as a signal to the niggers to come down and be recruited. In 3 days we got not a boy. The niggers came off to us in their canoes by hundreds, but they only laughed when we showed them beads and calico and hatchets and talked of the delights of plantation work in Samoa. On the fourth day there came a change. 50-odd boys signed on, and were billeted in the main hold, with the freedom of the deck, of course. And of course, looking back, this wholesale signing on was suspicious, but at the time we thought some powerful chief had removed the ban against recruiting. The morning of the fifth day our two boats went ashore as usual, one to cover the other, you know, in case of trouble. And, as usual, the 50 niggers on board were on deck, loafing, talking, smoking, and sleeping. Saxterf and myself, along with 4 other sailors, were all that were left on board. The 2 boats were manned with Gilbert Islanders. In the one were the captain, the supercargo, and the recruiter. In the other, which was the covering boat, and which lay offshore 100 yards, was the second mate. Both boats were well armed, though trouble was little expected. 4 of the sailors, including Saxterf, were scraping the poop rail. The 5th sailor, rifle in hand, was standing guard by the water tank just forward of the mainmast. I was forward, putting in the finishing licks on a new jaw for the fore gaff. I was just reaching for my pipe, where I had laid it down, when I heard a shot from shore. I straightened up to look. Something struck me on the back of the head, partially stunning me, and knocking me to the deck. My first thought was that something had carried away aloft, but even as I went down, and before I struck the deck, I heard the devil's own tattoo of rifles from the boats, and twisting sidewise, I caught a glimpse of the sailor who was standing guard. 2 big niggers were holding his arms, and a 3rd nigger from behind was braining him with a tomahawk. I can see it now, the water tank, the mainmast, the gang hanging onto him, the hatchet descending on the back of his head, and all under the blazing sunlight. I was fascinated by that growing vision of death. The tomahawk seemed to take a horribly long time to come down. I saw it land, and the man's legs give under him as he crumpled. The niggers held him up by sheer strength, while he was hacked a couple of times more. Then I got 2 more hacks on the head and decided that I was dead. So did the brute that was hacking me. I was too helpless to move, and I lay there and watched them removing the sentry's head. I must say they did it slick enough. They were old hands at the business. The rifle firing from the boats had ceased, and I made no doubt that they were finished off, and that the end had come to everything. It was only a matter of moments when they would return for my head. They were evidently taking the heads from the sailors aft. Heads are valuable on Malaita, especially white heads. They have the place of honor in the canoe houses of the saltwater natives. What particular decorative effect the bushmen get out of them I didn't know, but they prize them just as much as the saltwater crowd. I had a dim notion of escaping, and I crawled on hands and knees to the winch, where I managed to drag myself to my feet. From there I could look aft, and see 3 heads on top the cabin, the heads of 3 sailors I had given orders to for months. The niggers saw me standing, and started for me. I reached for my revolver, and found they had taken it. I can't say that I was scared. I've been near to death several times, but it never seemed easier than right then. I was half stunned, and nothing seemed to matter. The leading nigger had armed himself with a cleaver from the galley, and he grimaced like an ape as he prepared to slice me down. But the slice was never made. He went down on the deck all of a heap, and I saw the blood gush from his mouth. In a dim way I heard a rifle go off, and continue to go off. Nigger after nigger went down. My senses began to clear, and I noted that there was never a miss. Every time that the rifle went off, a nigger dropped. I sat down on deck beside the winch and looked up. Perched in the crosstrees was Sagsturf. How he had managed it, I can't imagine, for he had carried up with him two Winchesters and I don't know how many bandoliers of ammunition. And he was now doing the one only thing in this world that he was fitted to do. I've seen shooting and slaughter, but I never saw anything like that. I sat by the winch and watched the show. I was weak and faint, and it seemed to be all a dream. Bang, 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 went his rifle, and thud, 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 went the niggers to the deck. It was amazing to see them go down. After their first rush to get me, when about a dozen had dropped, they seemed paralyzed. But he never left off pumping his gun. By this time, canoes and the two boats arrived from shore, armed with Sniders, and with Winchesters which they had captured in the boats. The fusillade they let loose on Sagsturf was tremendous. Luckily for him, the niggers are only good at close range. They are not used to putting the gun to their shoulders. They wait until they are right on top of a man, and then they shoot from the hip. When his rifle got too hot, Sagsturf changed off. That had been his idea when he carried two rifles up with him. The astounding thing was the rapidity of his fire. Also, he never made a miss. If ever anything was inevitable, that man was. It was the swiftness of it that made the slaughter so appalling. The niggers did not have time to think. When they did manage to think, they went over the side in a rush, capsizing the canoes, of course. Sagsturf never let up. The water was covered with them, and plump, 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 he dropped his bullets into them. Not a single miss, and I could hear distinctly the thud of every bullet as it buried in human flesh. The niggers spread out and headed for the shore, swimming. The water was carpeted with bobbing heads, and I stood up, as in a dream, and watched it all, the bobbing heads and the heads that ceased to bob. Some of the long shots were magnificent. Only one man reached the beach, but as he stood up to wade ashore, Sagsturf got him. It was beautiful. And when a couple of niggers ran down to drag him out of the water, Sagsturf got them too. I thought everything was over then, when I heard the rifle go off again. A nigger had come out of the cabin companion on the run for the rail, and gone down in the middle of it. The cabin must have been full of them. I counted 20. They came up one at a time and jumped for the rail. But they never got there. It reminded me of trap shooting. A black body would pop out of the companion, bang would go Sagsturf's rifle, and down would go the black body. Of course, those below did not know what was happening on deck, so they continued to pop out until the last one was finished off. Sagsturf waited a while to make sure, and then came down on deck. He and I were all that were left of the Duchess's complement, and I was pretty well to the bad, while he was helpless now that the shooting was over. Under my direction he washed out my scalp wounds, and sewed them up. A big drink of whiskey braced me to make an effort to get out. There was nothing else to do. All the rest were dead. We tried to get up sail, Sagsturf hoisting and I holding the turn. He was once more the stupid lubber. He couldn't hoist worth a cent, and when I fell in a faint, it looked all up with us. When I came to, Sagsturf was sitting helplessly on the rail, waiting to ask me what he should do. I told him to overhaul the wounded, and see if there were any able to crawl. He gathered together six. One, I remember, had a broken leg. But Sagsturf said his arms were all right. I lay in the shade, brushing the flies off and directing operations, while Sagsturf bossed his hospital gang. I'll be blessed if he didn't make those poor niggers heave at every rope on the pin rails before he found the halyards. One of them let go the rope in the midst of the hoisting and slipped down to the deck dead, but Sagsturf hammered the others and made them stick by the job. When the fore and main were up, I told him to knock the shackle out of the anchor chain, and let her go. I had it myself helped aft to the wheel, where I was going to make a shift at steering. I can't guess how he did it, but instead of knocking the shackle out, down went the second anchor, and there we were doubly moored. In the end he managed to knock both shackles out, and raise the staysail and jib, and the Duchess filled away for the entrance. Our decks were a spectacle. Dead and dying niggers were everywhere. They were wedged away, some of them in the most inconceivable places. The cabin was full of them, where they had crawled off the deck and cashed in. I put Saxterf and his graveyard gang to work heaving them overside, and over they went, the living and the dead. The sharks had fat pickings that day. Of course our four murdered sailors went the same way. Their heads, however, we put in a sack with weights, so that by no chance should they drift on the beach, and fall into the hands of the niggers. Our five prisoners I decided to use as crew, but they decided otherwise. They watched their opportunity, and went over the side. Saxterf got two in midair with his revolver, and would have shot the other three in the water, if I hadn't stopped him. I was sick of the slaughter, you see, and besides, they'd helped work the schooner out. But it was mercy thrown away, for the sharks got the three of them. I had brain fever or something, after we got clear of the land. Anyway, the Duchess lay hove to for 3 weeks, when I pulled myself together, and we jogged on with her to Sydney. Anyway, those niggers of Malu learned the everlasting lesson, that it is not good to monkey with a white man. In their case, Saxterf was certainly inevitable. Charlie Roberts emitted a long whistle and said, "Well, I should say so. But whatever became of Saxterf?" Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.